Okay, let's unpack this. The surprising truth about your brain's ability to change.
Yeah.
We've been diving deep into this incredible world of neuroplasticity using a whole stack of articles, research findings, notes, and forget that old static picture of the brain just being fixed after childhood.
Right, like set in stone.
Exactly. The material we explored, it paints a picture of something far more dynamic, constantly rewiring itself.
And our mission here is really to pull out the absolute most important insights from all that information.
Yeah.
We want to get to the core concepts, the mechanisms that explain how this amazing process of brain change actually happens.
Precisely. Because understanding how your brain learns, how it adapts, how it even recovers from challenges, well, it isn't just academic, is it?
Not at all.
It can fundamentally change how you think about your own potential, your own capacity.
Absolute.
Get ready for some definite aha moments, I think.
Definitely. So let's start right at the beginning.
Yeah.
What exactly is neuroplasticity?
Good question.
The concept really revolves around that word plasticity
Yeah.
itself. You know, the quality of being easily shaped or molded, like plastic, compared to something rigid.
Right, like clay versus rock.
Exactly.
And applying that to the brain, what we found is that it's the capacity of neurons and their vast networks to actually change their connections and their behavior.
And this happens in response to pretty much everything, right?
Yeah, new information, sensory stimulation, just normal development, damage, even dysfunction.
So it's essentially the brain's built-in capability for its neurons and circuits to literally change structure and function.
And what's fascinating is that this change happens at multiple scales.
Yeah, it's not just one level.
No, we saw it can be microscopic, like within a single neuron, maybe changing the number or the shape of its connections, its synapses.
Or it can be massive across huge neural pathways involving, you know, countless neurons all working together.
This really represents a huge shift in our understanding compared to, well, decades ago.
Oh, absolutely. The older view is that the nervous system was largely hardwired, fixed early in life.
And significant damage after that point, often considered permanent.
Right. But the more recent research just keeps revealing how incredibly adaptable the brain really is. It shows it's an ongoing, lifelong process.
We saw this described as the good news and bad news aspect, which I thought was interesting.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Huh.
The good news is that the nervous system's capacity for development is ongoing. It can heal from many types of damage or at least compensate for loss.
But the bad news, well, it's not a magic wand for everything.
No.
It doesn't work equally well for every part of the brain, and that capacity, it does generally seem to weaken as we age.
Okay, so how does this incredible rewiring actually happen? Like down at the microscopic level, what are the brain's core tools for making these changes?
Right, this is where we get into the mechanisms. And, you know, while the line between physical changes, structural changes, and changes in activity, well, it isn't always crystal clear.
It can be blurry.
Yeah. But there are core processes we absolutely need to understand.
And the big ones you'll encounter repeatedly when you look into plasticity are long-term potentiation, long-term depression, and synaptic pruning.
Okay, let's start with long-term potentiation, LTP.
Right.
This is where, when a particular connection, a synapse, is stimulated repeatedly so, signals are sent across it over and over, its response actually gets stronger.
It becomes more efficient. Higher response.
Exactly.
And this isn't just some, you know, biological detail. This is considered fundamental for synaptic plasticity. It's often seen as the physical basis for learning anything or forming memories.
So every time you practice something, every time you recall a piece of information, you're likely strengthening specific neural connections through LTP.
That seems to be the idea. You're building a well-trodden path in the brain, like you said. The more you use it, the clearer and faster it becomes.
Makes sense. We saw that illustrated by that cluster hippocampus experiment.
Right, the setup is pretty clear. You have two pathways of neurons. Pathway one gets stimulated many times, building up this experience.
Well, pathway two is just the control, right? Not getting that repeated stimulation.
Exactly. Then you give the same single stimulus to both pathways.
And the response in pathway one, the one that was practiced, is much, much stronger.
Yep. It shows that history of activation fundamentally changed the connection strength. powerful stuff.
And LTP isn't just confined to the hippocampus, which we know is key for memory.
No, it's pretty widespread.
We saw it observed in lots of areas and pathways, sensory systems like the visual and auditory cortex, connections involved in movement.
Really, across various specific pathways listed in the material we looked at.
Okay, so LTP strengthens connections, but then there's long-term depression, LTD.
Right, which is essentially the opposite process.
Wait, so LTD makes connections weaker. Why? Why would the brain ever want to weaken connections? That seems kind of counterintuitive for learning.
That's a great question. And it does seem strange at first glance. But it's actually crucial for efficiency and flexibility.
How so?
LTD happens when a synapse is repeatedly stimulated, but in a way that actually decreases its response over time. Think of it like actively turning down the volume on certain neural conversations that aren't useful right now. Or maybe we're learned incorrectly.
Okay. So maybe it's about clearing out clutter or making room for new, more relevant connections or perhaps even unlearning things.
Exactly. It's vital for things like forgetting irrelevant details or refining motor skills by suppressing inefficient movements. Mm. It allows the brain to adapt to new information without getting totally overloaded.
Okay.
The material we had showed visually how stimulation can gradually decrease a synaptic response, and then sometimes it drops off quite significantly.
All right, so we can strengthen connections with LTP, weaken them with LTD. What about just getting rid of them entirely? That brings us to synaptic pruning, doesn't it?
Yes, and I love the gardening analogy here that we came across.
You too.
It's like cutting off unused or less useful branches, the synapses in this case. It's the process of removing connections that aren't being used effectively or aren't contributing to a circuit anymore.
And looking at the developmental timeline for this is just fascinating.
It really is.
From early in development, like embryonic stages, up to about age 2, there's this explosive growth, both neurons and synapses. The brain's building this massive, maybe even overly massive network.
Kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what
sticks. Yeah. Then, starting around age 2 and lasting pretty dramatically until about age 10, there's a rapid drop in synapses. This is the period of intense pruning.
Right. It continues through adolescence, though maybe a bit slower, and into early adulthood, particularly in the prefrontal cortex.
The area for planning and decision making.
Exactly. And it seems to taper off maybe in the late 20s.
So my teenage brain was literally trimming the fat. That explains a lot.
Chuckles lightly.
Perhaps. But seriously, why is this intense pruning so necessary? What's the point?
Well, it's thought to be crucial for efficiency and specialization. It allows the brain to become more streamlined, more efficient for the specific environment and experiences you are having.
Tailoring itself.
Precisely. For example, in the visual cortex, synapses peak around 8 months old. But then pruning kicks in as the baby starts getting structured visual input. It shapes those connections based on what the baby actually sees.
We also saw that there are theories linking disruptions in this pruning process to certain conditions.
Right. It's important territory. For example, some research notes a theory, and it is a theory that schizophrenia might involve overpruning, removing too many necessary connections.
And conversely.
Conversely, theories about autism or maybe savant abilities sometimes suggest underpruning, retaining perhaps too many or too diverse connections.
But it's really important to stress, like material did, these are complex associations and theories, not simple cause and effect.
Yeah, absolutely crucial point. And just to quickly touch on a related term we saw, synaptic strengthening. As used in the material, this just refers generally to any mechanism like LTP or maybe physical structural changes that makes a synaptic connection stronger.
Got it. And there was also denervation supersensitivity.
Yes, a kind of compensatory mechanism.
If some of the neurons connecting to another neuron are lost, they get denervated. The neuron on the receiving end can become extra sensitive.
How does it do that?
By developing more receptors for the neurotransmitters, it does still receive. It's trying to catch every signal it can.
Fascinating adaptation. It's seen, for instance, in skeletal muscle when nerve connections are damaged. Though the material noted, it does depend on the scope of the damage. Severe loss might overwhelm this kind of attempt.
Okay, so those are the core tools the brain uses to tune the strength and presence of existing connections. But what about creating entirely new ones? Can the adult brain actually do that?
This brings us to adult neurogenesis, which was, frankly, a truly surprising discovery for the field.
Yeah, because for a long time, the prevailing belief was that adult mammals just couldn't generate new functional neurons. You had what you had.
Right. The dogma was no new neurons after a certain point.
But it turns out they can, though, and this is crucial, it happens in very restricted areas of the nervous system.
Where specifically?
Most notably in the hippocampus, that memory center we keep coming back to. So the adult brain can grow new brain cells, but definitely not everywhere.
Still, pretty remarkable. Now, another set of important concepts relate to how the brain handles damage or loss. We saw equipotentiality and vicariation mentioned.
Equipotentiality. Sounds complicated. We saw it originated from some early research on memory using lesion studies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Damaging parts of the brain.
Yes. And the general idea was that intact parts of a brain system could potentially take over for damaged parts.
The material discussed two ways this term has been used, I think.
It did. One was a very early, broad hypothesis suggesting memory and function were just globally distributed, maybe less useful now.
And the other.
The other, and perhaps more relevant definition, suggests that any portion of a specific brain region might potentially take over the function of a damaged part of that same region.
Okay, that makes more sense. And then vicariation, which feels related, but maybe slightly different.
Yeah, it's about compensation. Vicariation is where one brain area compensates for the loss or damage of another area entirely. A different region steps up.
Ah.
And the examples we saw really bring this to life, don't they?
Definitely. Think about compensation for paralysis after a stroke. The undamaged side of the motor system might get stronger to help out.
Or compensation for memory issues after a traumatic brain injury. Maybe new connections develop in related areas to sort of route around the damaged spot.
Or those incredible adaptations we see with sensory loss.
Exactly. Someone with hearing loss might significantly strengthen their visual processing for things like lip reading or sign language.
And someone with vision loss might boost their auditory or tactile processing. The brain is literally finding new ways to get the job done by recruiting different areas. Very clever.
And finally, there was diaschesis, which is a slightly different consequence of damage.
Right. This was the temporary thing.
Exactly. It's the observation of a temporary decrease in function in a brain region that wasn't directly damaged itself, but is connected to the area that was damaged.
So it's like a ripple effect of the injury. The connected areas get stunned for a bit.
Precisely. That's a good way to think about it. The exact mechanism isn't fully understood, but it's thought to involve temporary disruption of synaptic activity or neurotransmitter levels in those connected areas.
And we saw examples like temporary function loss after things like stroke, brain surgery, or concussion.
Which then often recovers over time as the system stabilizes.
Okay, so we've explored the tools and concepts, LTP, LTD, pruning, neurogenesis, compensation like vicariation, even temporary effects like diaschesis. Let's talk about the bigger picture. Where and when does this amazing plasticity happen most?
Well, as we touched on earlier, plasticity generally varies with age. It's incredibly active when you're very young, especially in those first few years. Massive changes happening.
But, and the material strongly emphasizes this, it absolutely continues throughout life.
Yeah, that's key.
It's constantly happening as you learn new things, as you accumulate experiences, form memories, and crucially, as the brain attempts to compensate after injury or other challenges.
And it's worth reiterating that neuroplasticity, while incredibly powerful, isn't some kind of universal fix-all.
Right. It has limits.
Some brain regions might just show less capacity for change than others, and recovery is definitely limited if the damage is too severe or too widespread.
And speaking of regions, the material pointed out that some areas seem inherently more plastic when it comes to changing circuits in response to normal, everyday experiences.
Right. Areas like the hippocampus, the visual cortex, the motor cortex, and the prefrontal cortex were highlighted.
Which makes sense, right? Those are heavily involved in learning, memory, sensory processing, planning, movement areas that need to adapt based on your interaction with the world.
Exactly. And then some regions seem to have a higher probability of recovery from damage.
Like the hippocampus, perhaps because of that adult neurogenesis we discussed.
Possibly. And the motor cortex also seems quite good at reorganizing function after injury.
Conversely, areas like the visual cortex and maybe the prefrontal cortex might have a lower probability of fully recovering their original function after significant damage.
Although, as we discussed with vicariation, other areas might step in to compensate for the lost function.
And finally, some areas just seem generally less plastic overall.
Yeah, like the basal ganglia, heavily involved in more automated movement, habit formation. Less neurogenesis there, apparently.
And the primary auditory cortex involved in basic sound processing seems less plastic than the visual cortex, according to the sources.
Okay, enough with the mechanisms and regions for a moment. Let's bring this all to life. We found some really striking real-world examples that show these principles in action.
Oh yeah, the London taxi driver's study. That's a classic, isn't it? Really shows adult structural plasticity.
It really is fantastic. This research looked at London taxi drivers who have to go through years of incredibly intense training to memorize the city's unbelievably complex layout. They call it the knowledge.
Thousands of streets, landmarks. It's insane.
Totally. And what they found was that these experienced drivers had significantly larger posterior hippocampi compared to control groups.
And that's the part of the hippocampus involved in spatial navigation, right? Remembering routes and locations.
Exactly. And crucially, these weren't kids. The drivers were adults. Average age was 44. They'd been licensed for years, sometimes decades.
And the size increase correlated directly with how long they'd been on the job.
Yep. More time driving, bigger posterior hippocampus. It's real-world experience physically changing the adult brain structure. Amazing.
Another great example showing learning causing structural change, second language acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Studies show that learning a new language actually increases gray matter density in a specific area, the left inferior parietal cortex.
And what's truly fascinating here is the correlation they found. It wasn't just that it increased, but how much?
Right. The higher your proficiency in that second language,
the higher the gray matter density in that spot. And also, the earlier in life you acquired the language, the higher the density too.
It's concrete evidence of the brain physically adapting to these complex cognitive demands. Learning literally builds brain matter.
We also saw powerful examples of sensory compensation. When one sense is affected, how the brain adapts.
Especially in visually impaired individuals, those blind from an early age, their visual cortex, the part normally dedicated to sight in the occipital lobe, It can get completely repurposed.
Right. It doesn't just sit idle. In people blind from birth or early childhood, it can actually be thicker and show greater plasticity, retaining more diverse connections, maybe.
That's one idea mentioned. And this area gets recruited to process input from other senses, like touch for reading Braille or hearing, even smell.
And it's not just in people born blind. Even in sighted adults, just learning Braille causes observable changes.
Yet, over just 8 months of learning, you see both functional shifts, brain networks adapting to process tactile input as reading, and structural changes. Changes in gray matter volume, tissue properties like myelin, and sensory areas.
Learning changes the brain, period.
Seems so. Finally, some of the most dramatic examples came from those case studies involving significant brain damage, especially in young brains where plasticity is arguably at its peak.
Like the case of Cheryl Schultz. She lost her sense of balance completely due to inner ear damage from medication.
Terrible thing to happen.
Yeah. But her brain adapted to use input from a completely artificial system, sensors on a helmet sending signals to a little strip she held in her mouth.
And that allowed her to regain balance control.
Yes. It's an incredible example of compensation via completely novel sensory pathways. The brain figured out how to interpret these new signals as balance information.
Wow. Then there was the 6-year-old boy.
Oh, the hemispherectomy case. He had a third of his right brain removed, including most of his visual areas, to stop devastating seizures.
Just unimaginable.
But despite losing critical brain tissue, his left hemisphere, which normally isn't dominant for things like face and object recognition in that way, took over those visual functions.
The left side compensated for the right side's visual loss.
Apparently so. And get this. His IQ actually slightly increased after the surgery from 116 to 118. It just shows the incredible resilience and reorganization possible in a young brain.
Absolutely astonishing. And there was another hemispherectomy case, Maura Lieb.
Yes, she had a stroke before birth that damaged her left hemisphere.
So the damage was very, very early.
Extremely early. It led to a hemispherectomy when she was just 9 months old. But her right hemisphere completely reorganized. It took over typical left side functions like speech and motor control.
With therapy support, of course.
Oh, yes. Intensive therapy was crucial. But again, it highlights the truly massive reorganization and vicariation potential in very, very young brains.
And what does this all mean when you pull it together? What's the big picture from all this material?
Well, what we've unpacked paints a picture of a remarkably adaptable brain. It's not static at all.
No, it's constantly being sculpted, reshaped, not just during some critical period in childhood, but by your experiences, your learning, challenges like injury. throughout your entire life.
It really is a dynamic process, not just a fixed organ.
And while the capacity for change might decrease somewhat with age or vary by brain region, significant adaptation seems always possible, at least to some degree.
And this knowledge, understanding this, it's incredibly empowering for you, the listener.
Mm-hmm.
It means the effort you put into learning something new isn't just about acquiring information abstractly, it's physically changing the structure and function of your brain.
Recovery from injury, while often difficult, is possible because of this inherent capacity for reorganization.
And your sensory experiences aren't just passively registering, they're actively shaping your neural pathways every single day.
We've taken a deep dive into the mechanics, how connections strengthen and weaken, LTP and LTD, how unused ones get pruned away,
how new neurons can sometimes form, adult neurogenesis, and how the brain compensates for loss through things like vicariation.
And we've seen those striking real-world examples from taxi drivers' hippocampi literally growing to children effectively rewiring half their brain after surgery.
So here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Considering all these mechanisms are working together, constantly reshaping your neural landscape based on your unique history, the experiences you choose, the challenges you face.
Yeah, it's happening right now in all of us.
Exactly. Which raises an important question for you. How does understanding this dynamic, this ever-changing nature of your own brain, how does that influence how you think about, say, tackling a difficult new skill?
Or facing a personal challenge that requires real adaptation? Or even just deciding how you spend your time and what you expose your brain to every single day.
Think about the profound implications of having a brain that's fundamentally a process, not just a fixed structure. Something to really ponder until our next deep dive.